Welcome to Chicoji, everybody. Today's speaker is Koan Jenka from Santa Barbara. And he is an old, I met him a long time ago in the mountains of Santa Barbara for a Meizumi Roshi Sesshin. And lost touch for decades, like several. And then I went and started doing some prison work at a place out in the middle of nowhere called Pleasant Valley. There's even a Pleasant Valley Cemetery near there. With fresh bouquets everywhere. Even though it's in the very arid west San Joaquin Valley, east of King City, about 60 miles. So I started working, going there for Buddhist services, and one of the inmates that was in the D Yard Sangha had been, his teacher was this guy Koan from LA Zen Center, and he was going to receive precepts from him. So I checked up on this guy, and I found I knew this guy, and so we ended up giving Irwin. Where you gave him the precepts, and we had a nice ceremony. So.
Well, thank you all for allowing me to be here today. Appreciate the invitation. And it was a real kick in the head when Reverend Doug and I realized that we knew each other. That, when is this the guy I used to sit with 35 years ago in Santa Barbara? And sure enough, yeah, there he is in the flesh. And what was remarkable was the first Friday that we showed up there together. We showed up at the gate with a big smile on our face and couldn't go in because they were on lockdown. They had some kind of flu bug running around, so everybody was quarantined. And so we had both just driven 200 miles to get there. And this happens in prison work more often than I like to think. So I found we discovered that Coalinga, in fact, has a Starbucks, and so we spent some time catching up on things. It was really wonderful. It's a great privilege to work with you there. In fact, I often think of prison work as being kind of the lazy man's ministry, and the reason I say that is the suffering is so obvious there. You don't have to work very hard to encounter it. It just kind of comes and slaps you upside the face, and almost every person that we talk to is deeply suffering in some way. And of course you can say, well, that's what they get, right? They did whatever they did to get in that place, and so they're getting their just desserts. And in some ways that's a correct argument. Also, you know, our job as priests and as teachers is to address suffering wherever we find it, or whatever form we find it in. And so, again, it's not so hard to do there. And prisons by their very nature are just incredibly chaotic and noisy places. It's very difficult for any of these people we work with to find a quiet time. And some of them will get up at, you know, 4 in the morning to sit, or maybe wait until midnight when most people have gone to sleep, and in order to try to sit. And those who have cells are actually the fortunate ones. The unfortunate ones are the ones who are living in dormitories that have 15 or 16 men in a room. And you can just imagine how difficult it's got to be to sit under those circumstances, and yet some people manage to do it, you know, they really do. We also try to encourage them to realize the fact that they're living in a state-sponsored monastery for all practical purposes, and so they have a choice to make. You see, they can choose to be miserable and fight the system, or they can choose to kind of transcend the system, if that's what they choose to do. And so we encourage them to use this as an opportunity to develop your spiritual life and to essentially be a monk, because you are. So And some people take that to heart and others don't. One of the things that we encounter too leads me to what I wanted to talk about today. It's very often, or it's very easy when you have just gotten five life sentences, or 35 to life, or 50 to life, or something like that, to think that your life is pretty much over. And, you know, it takes a little bit of work sometimes to convince people that your life is not over, it's just different. And you can still carve out a meaningful life for yourself in this environment here, okay? Through practice and through an attitude adjustment of some kind. And so what I want to talk about today was meaning. And this is kind of an elaboration on a talk I gave last week at Pleasant Valley State Prison. And why they call it Pleasant Valley still escapes me. But it's, as Doug says, it's out in the middle of nowhere near Coalinga. And there's a magazine called The Week. I don't know how familiar you all are with it, but my partner and I get it. And it's a condensation of the news from around the world for the previous week. And I read it almost cover to cover. It's a lot of interesting stuff in there. But back in February, there was an article in there called The Good Life, or A Good Life. And it was written by a woman, a researcher, who was studying happiness and the difference between happiness and meaningfulness. And she drew very heavily on the work of Viktor Frankl, who most of you have probably heard of. His book, which he published in 1946, was called Man's Search for Meaning. And it was a very impactful book. And it was one that sat on my library shelf for probably 25 years. Before I finally realized, okay, today's the day, I'm going to pick this up, and I'm going to read this book, and because I'd seen a reference to it somewhere. And it was a pretty amazing book. I don't know how much you know about Viktor Frankl, but he was an Austrian, lived in Vienna. He was a very up-and-coming young neurologist and psychiatrist, and was making quite a name for himself. He had studied with Freud and Jung and all of the contemporaries of his day and had published quite a lot that was well received. And but also it was at a time where Germany was beginning to take over the world, or attempt to. And so he applied for an exit visa for he and his wife to come to the United States. And in 1941, he did get that exit visa. But he was also faced with a dilemma, which was, do I leave my parents here to fend for themselves and suffer whatever fate they suffer, or do I stay here and take care of my parents as best I can? And in 1942, he made the decision to stay, okay, to care for his parents, to honor his mother and his father. And, of course, later that year, then the family was rounded up and taken off to the camps. And his wife, who was pregnant at the time, was killed, as were his parents also died. He was the only one in the family to survive. And being a psychiatrist and a kind of an observer of human nature, he, you know, paid very close attention to what was going on with his fellow campmates. And one of the things he noticed, first of all, was that some people simply gave up. Okay, that this they felt that, you know, their life for all practical purposes was ended, it had no purpose. Why stay here and suffer this abuse? And he says you could always identify who these people were, because if they had any contraband cigarettes, they would smoke them. And if they had anything else, they would eat it. And basically, it would stop showing up for work. And so within a few days, they'd be gone. And but he noticed there were some people who just through it all, you know, were able to persevere and to just keep going, you know, day after day. In fact, you've heard that in the Zendo, probably, just keep going. It's the best piece of advice I ever got from a teacher was just keep going. Doesn't matter what comes up, you know. Pain comes up, just keep going. Sadness comes up, just keep going. Joy comes up, just keep going. Doesn't matter, just keep going. And he noticed that some people were capable of doing this. And one of the things he noticed, in fact, he was working with, he cites a couple of suicidal inmates that he was working with who were really kind of at the end of their rope and really felt that life simply had nothing else to give them at this point. And what he was able to do was to show them that while they could not expect anything from life, particularly, that life still expected something from them. Cold seems to be endless. Just as the dharmas are boundless, cold seem to be endless. In the one case he was dealing with, this inmate had a young son that he had sent off to another country where he would be safe. And for him, living to see his son again was what kept driving him forward. Okay. For another man who was a mathematician and a scientist, was finishing the publication of a treatise that he had begun before he was arrested. And so this became his kind of driving issue, was to survive, to finish and publish this work. And so so Frankl observed that it was the people who found meaning in life under whatever dire circumstances were the ones who survived, the ones who made it through in some way. And this has a parallel, clearly, in the prison work that we do, that those who, and some do, find a way to create a very meaningful life. Obviously, they would prefer to be outside, but they realize that's not going to happen anytime soon, and so they're able to carve out for themselves to create a life of great meaning. Okay, many of the men that I know, like at CMC, for example, they have a hospice there, and a lot of the men volunteer in the hospice program, and it's a very, very important thing that they're doing there. But one kind of the bottom line that Frankl found was that you could take everything you could away from a person, from a human being, except for one thing, and that was the attitude with which we responded to or dealt with our particular situation. That we always have a choice as to how we respond to a given set of circumstances. And very often, you'll hear people say, well, I had no choice. And I say, ah, baloney. You know, you always have a choice. You just didn't like the other options, that's all. You know, maybe we're perceived as being more onerous, I don't know. But I began also, as I was reading the article, to see a lot of parallels between what Frankl was observing and what we observe in the prisons. But also there's some very direct connections and links to our Dharma practice here, to the teachings of the Buddha. And so it's really kind of those connections that I wanted to try to draw today and leave you to make the final connections. One thing to appreciate is that most of us seek a life of happiness. This is what the researcher who wrote the article was observing or studying, was how do we do this? And usually it's an effort to meet our needs, okay, that we have a need for some kind of pleasure, some kind of sensory enjoyment or something. Could be a psychological state having to do with status or prestige, with titles, could be a lot of things. But we're constantly striving for happiness. And happiness is fleeting. It doesn't last. We're only happy as long as we're getting the things that satisfy our needs. The moment that stops, it's difficult to be happy. Okay, that's why in a prison it's pretty damn difficult to be happy, because you don't have a lot of control over satisfying your needs. But also, it was the realization of that that really was kind of the first step I can identify on my particular path, which was, 40 years ago now, was the realization that, you know, I could work my life off, or work my head off all my life, and never be happy, simply because 3 days or 3 weeks after I got something that I desperately wanted or thought that I had to have, something new would arise. It was always more, better, or different. It was a better job, it was more money, it was a wife, and then a new wife, and a better wife. And it was always this endless, boundless kind of desire that we have. And of course, what did the Buddha teach us? Well, first of all, dukkha, you know, that we live a life of dissatisfaction or unhappiness. And there's a cause of that, and the cause is desire, the fact that we want this stuff. We're trying to constantly achieve happiness by getting stuff, okay? And, of course, stuff doesn't last. And just another thing that he taught us was that no conditioned thing, and by that he means nothing which is created through causes and conditions, which for all practical purposes is everything except one. That none of those things are going to bring us happiness because they're impermanent, and our psychology is such that we're going to want something else a few days later. It was really realization that kind of launched me on my particular path. I didn't connect with Zen until a couple of years later, but still, I remember that as a significant turning point for me. But on the other hand of the other side of the coin is a meaningful life, is meaning. Okay? That it's quite possible. In fact, what the researcher found was that people who had what they described as a meaningful life, something that gave their life meaning, a reason to get up in the morning, okay, a reason to do what they do, that gave them self-satisfaction, okay, that they felt good about at the end of the day, that was more enduring. Okay, that it didn't disappear when you went to bed at night. Okay, it lasted. And that meaning inevitably involved some kind of service to others. Now, she also points out that people who report having a meaningful life tend not to be as happy as people who simply pursue happiness. Okay. But on the other hand, it is offset by the longer-term duration of the meaningfulness of their life. And so our encouragement to the men is always to seek meaning in their life, something that's meaningful to them, which again always involves others. And if you remember the three pure precepts, among the 16 bodhisattva precepts, or the three pure precepts, the first is cease from evil, the second is do good, and the third is do good for others. Okay, so that's not there out of some, what I call it, fanciful notion of or idealistic notion. It's there because that's what works. It's there because that's what gives meaning to life. At some point in your Zen career, you've probably heard of or studied or read about or seen the 10 ox herding pictures. And if you remember what happens in the last picture, the monk who was pursuing the ox, who found the ox, who forgot the ox, forgot himself, he's going off into the village with helping hands. He's going off to simply do what needs to be done, okay, in the service of others. And that's one of the vows that we take as priests when we ordain, is to serve the Sangha. Okay, and whether that Sangha is free or whether it's incarcerated, doesn't really matter. That's our Sangha.
None of them are free.
True. They have travel restrictions.
All of us. Huh?
All of us have travel restrictions. Yeah, we're maybe not so free either. You know, we all build prisons in our minds. And it's those prisons that often bring us to Zen practice. Yeah, I haven't taught beginning instruction for meditation for quite some period of time now, but when I did, I would always begin the class by asking people, what brought you here? You know, this crazy thing to do. Why do you want to come do Zen practice, you know? And, yeah, you'd hear the usual stuff. Well, I want to learn to relax, and I want to learn to mellow out and do these things. But, you know, with a little bit of pushing and scratching, there'd be some people who would tell you, well, I'm here because I'm in pain. You know, there's something going on in my life. I'm miserable, and I'm seeking relief from that pain. Okay, and I've heard that meditation can do that or something like that. I always recommend good whiskey, but meditation takes a lot longer. The other, and again, this is what the Buddha taught us, is that, you know, if we're human beings, we suffer, right? And again, there is a way out of our suffering, and it is the way, capital W, way. That's the way we do it. He laid it out very, very clearly. We didn't have to think too much about it. It's all right there. There's also some people who will say that they feel as though something is missing. You know, there's just something missing. I mean, I got the nice car, I got the great job, I got a beautiful boyfriend, I've got, you know, all of this stuff, but still there's something I can't quite grasp. You know, I can't put my finger on it, but I know that there's something missing. Okay. And this also speaks to our practice, or our practice speaks to it, I should say, in that what happens when we pursue the way? What happens to the little self? What do we discover? We discover big self. What happens to the little mind? The little mind drops away too. The dropping away of body and mind. And what is there instead? Big mind. Okay. We find that there was nothing missing at all. It's always been there since the very beginning. Okay. There's nothing missing at all. And we find out what that is. And when we find that out, there's great joy. And so it's that kind of joy that we can at least offer to people. And they can experience a big mind and big self just as easily behind bars as they can outside. Or maybe not as easily, but they have to work at it. But none of us do it easily, I think. It's for most of us, it's a period of practice, very intense practice. Yeah, in fact, that touches on something Dogen Zenji said, too, which is to study the Buddha is to study the self, and to study the self is to forget the self, and to forget the self is to be enlightened by the 10,000 things. And so it's when we give up this little self and we discover a big self, and we experience ourselves to where, you know, the ants, I can feel the ants crawling on my bark out there on that oak tree. Then we realize that, again, it was there all along, nothing missing. Okay, period, all complete right now, right here. I'm having a senior moment. I can't remember what I was going to say next. That's what happens. Oh, yeah, one of my notes here was that doing something meaningful is considered, it gives people self-reporting on what gives them a meaningful life, what makes their life meaningful, always transcends that self in some way. Okay, it's always transcending the self in service of others. And for some people, it may be, you know, working in a homeless shelter. For other people, it may be picking up trash on Normandy Avenue in Los Angeles. Can take a lot of forms, okay? And certainly, if you look around, there's a boundless number of opportunities here. For me, it's one of the things that really gives my life meaning is planting trees. I've been a city parks volunteer for, I don't know, 13, 14 years, maybe longer. And To the best of my reckoning, I've planted about 310 trees, and I'm a little short of 1,000, but there's something satisfying to me about planting trees, and knowing that I will never sit under that tree. Okay, there's something about that gives my life meaning, and so it's the most hopeful thing I can do. It's also my one-man war on global warming. You know, a tree sequesters about a ton of CO2 or carbon, and so that's a good thing. Huh? So anyway, you might just want to take a look to see what gives your life meaning. There's one other thing. Excuse me. I'm glad I don't have a microphone. When you're reading Frankl's experience in the camps, and also Elie Wiesel's work, his first work he publishes entitled Night, very, very interesting reading. And you have to ask yourself, what is it that allowed a people like the country of Germany, which is a very cultured race, they're not really a race, but a very cultured group of people, very intelligent group, tremendous accomplishments. What was it that allowed them to do what they did, okay, in the camps? And again, what does our teaching tell us about that? What's the fundamental human delusion?
Separation.
We're separate. That's the fundamental human delusion, is that we are separate, autonomous little creatures running around. What we don't see is that we're simply fingers of the same hand. Okay, and to cut off one finger to spite another finger makes no sense whatsoever. Okay, says something about that in the Bible, I think. And so through our practice, we realize, let me back up a little bit. Yeah, if I see you as separate, and not only separate but different than me, then that allows me to objectify you. Okay, I can make an object out of you, and then I can make judgments about that object. It's either better or it's worse, it's finer, it's poorer, it's lesser. And I can do something to you that without any repercussions to myself, I think, at the time, because again, we are separate. But again, we realize through our practice that we're not separate. Okay. But again, we're all truly, fingers in the same hand, and there's fundamentally no difference between the altar image there and you and I, okay, and that oak tree outside, or the turkeys running around. And nobody likes to be called a turkey, but hey, they're part of the family too. So, I think, in fact, I made copies of this article for all of you, and I think I have more than enough. Yeah, I'm fine. Got a couple extra even. So I want you, when you leave, you're encouraged, don't have to, certainly, but you're encouraged to take a copy of the article home and to read it and to ponder it, and just reflect on how it affects your practice. Okay, what are the connections between your practice and what Viktor Frankl was talking about or the researcher was talking about? And look to see how that informs what you do with your practice, okay, how you relate to others. So I could go on and on, I think, but this is probably far enough. Do you have questions and answers? Is that allowed?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Good. I like questions and answers. Takes me back to my primary days. Again, excuse me for this cold. I'm really glad I don't have a microphone attached.
Question.
Please.
You talk about meaningfulness, But I remember reading that Mayazumi Roshi said, we do Zazen just for Zazen. There's no meaning. Can you talk about that?
Sure. Sure. I'm trying to think of how to do this in 2,500 words or less. actually, one of the things we find as we practice, one of the promises that the Buddha made to all of us who choose to follow his path, his teachings, is that the practice brings us to a state of great joy and to a state of happiness that's not dependent upon circumstances. Okay? And and so what I've been talking about in terms of the pursuit of happiness or the pursuit of meaning is really occurring in the so-called relative sphere. Mm-hmm. Okay. Once we enter or have experienced the so-called absolute sphere, okay, at that point in time, our emotional state need no longer be conditioned by what's going on around us. Okay. So, in doing Zazen, we not only do it without, you know, a search for meaning, at the same time we do it with the great faith that mm-hmm. we will, in fact, at some point we're going to benefit from this profoundly. Right? Most of us have that expectation. The problem is we go into a sitting with an expectation that something will happen or that I will feel a certain way or that, I don't know, who knows what other expectations people come to sit with. And as soon as we set that up as a goal, whether it's meaning or it's happiness or it's transcendence or it's kensho or it's getting rid of the pain in my back. We've set up a goal which leads to disappointment and frustration if it doesn't happen. Mm-hmm. In fact, the biggest trap of all is that most of you have probably had this experience where you'll have this just incredible sitting period where you're just really grounded, really focused. I mean, it's just, this is the most amazing sitting period I've ever had in my life. And then the next day you try to get back there again and you can't. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that just leads to frustration and to disappointment. Mm-hmm. All right. And so it's better to not expect anything from your Zazen, whether it's meaning or it's anything else. Okay. Mm-hmm. Just go into it without expectations. Just do the practice. Okay. Just do whatever your practice is, whether it's koan practice or it's counting your breath or it's sitting shikantaza or whatever it is, just do that. Just completely do that. Thanks. Maybe people just want to go eat. Well, one thing I do want to add, I don't know if any of you are attracted to or interested in pursuing, you know, some prison ministry, but for lack of a better term, but we could sure use some help over Pleasant Valley. It's really tough with just two of us there. Reverend Doug gets to go once a month and I get to go once a month, and it's really not enough to maintain a consistent practice. And so you don't have to be ordained to do it. If you can teach someone how to meditate, if you can read a book, you could do it just as well as anybody else can. Okay. The important thing is to show up. You see, the men cannot meet as a group without a sponsor, without somebody either on staff or from the outside who's been through the approval process, without somebody there to conduct the service, or to let them conduct it and simply be present. Okay, you could do that too. All right. So if you have any inclination at all towards that, I encourage you to give it a try. We can Reverend Doug could arrange for you to get what we call a gate pass, which allows you to go in either one time or for 3 months or for 6 months.
You get to come out. It's not going in for 3 months.
Thank you for clarifying that. Yeah, in fact, another thing I've learned to never say in there is, I know how you feel. Because I don't. I've never lived there. And I don't know how they feel. Okay. I can imagine it. Okay. But I don't really know. So that's a practice in not knowing. So again, if any of you have any inclination at all, or know someone who does, please see the man here and encourage you to join us.
Yeah, to respond to your invitation, I read a book which you're probably familiar with called We're All Doing Time.
Yes, Lozoff.
Yeah.
Great book.
It's a wonderful book, and it inspired me to do some prison work. Mm-hmm. And your term of state-sponsored monastery, I think I went into that experience with that in mind, mm-hmm. That all the conditions pretty much are there.
Yeah.
For
living in
monastic
an ashram
life. Yeah. But what happened to me was that I went maybe 3 or 4 times and was deeply moved by the dedication of the Buddhist prisoners there. But for a long while, I couldn't understand why my whole system was completely undone by the experience. Mm-hmm. And it just came to me one day that I felt as if I was in a concentration camp. Mm-hmm. I did not feel as if I was in a state-sponsored monastery. The barbed wire, the complete, the uniforms, the noise, as you say, was just incredible. The most natural experience that one might have, like just opening a door, walking down a corridor, and just going to open, you can't open a door. You can't make any kind of dramatic movement, because there are all kinds of surveillance cameras that, and also there was absolutely nothing green there.
Yeah.
Like Pleasant Valley is really a travesty of it was completely, everything was concrete and nothing beautiful, nothing nurturing. Mm-hmm. I couldn't go back.
Mm-hmm.
But I can confirm your sense that just to have someone present to from the outside was so deeply meaningful to most. This is a man's prison.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow to have someone from the outside, beyond the walls of this forgotten land, to come in and recognize their existence,
mm-hmm.
I think was the most profoundly meaningful thing for
them. Yeah. And it can be a very profound experience for people, especially the first time you go in there with the doors clanging behind you and those kinds of things. And you bring up the point of being forgotten. Many, many, many of the inmates feel like the world's forgotten about them. Okay. And so someone coming in, as you say, once a week to recognize them, to be with them, to support them, is a very powerful thing to do. And again, it doesn't require any special skill, you know, so just got to show up. Who was it said that, you know, a lot of success in life is just showing up?
Mm-hmm.
Woody Allen, I think. Was it? I don't know.
Robin Williams, I believe.
Robin Williams? Okay, I'll accept that. Great.
I read Viktor Frankl's book. It's really wonderful. And in a lot of ways, kind of horrific on the first part. But I think what I took away from it was he said that what he found in the prisoners that were able to finally overcome the situation was this fantasy, kind of this belief that they, or they had done something. Like he had this paper that he hadn't, wasn't able to write, and so that was this prospect of something in the future, kept them driving on. And also, which I thought perhaps you could comment, was love for somebody.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, good question, for several reasons. When people suffer together, there can be a very deep bonding experience. Okay, that's part of what boot camp is about, and SEAL training and these kinds of things. There's a very deep bonding that occurs, and the military doesn't usually like to call it love, but it's this sense of the word escapes me, but I mean, often, you know, I've been told by a number of people who were in the midst of it that near the last few months of the war, I mean, Germany was quite aware that it was on the losing side, but yet they fought ferociously. But they weren't fighting for their country or for the Hitler or anybody. They were fighting for their buddies. Okay, they were fighting for the guy next to him. To keep them alive, to keep them from getting hurt, okay, to the very best that they could. So there's this deep sense of love and sometimes compassion. You know, these places were not without their compassionate acts of giving somebody a spoonful or two of soup or, you know, a small piece of bread or something. Zen is sometimes criticized. People will. So, you know, well, you're all about this kind of hard, austere training, you know, we beat you with sticks and all this stuff. You eat rice gruel every day and it's all this stuff. And, you know, where's the love? Where's the compassion? And, you know, it is there because if we walk on this path, if we stay on this path long enough, compassion naturally arises. When I see that you and I are no longer separate, what's going to happen? Am I going to hate you? No, not really. Okay, that's not going to happen. I feel compassion for you. In fact, another great book to look at, and I hear the dinner bell, so everybody's getting ready. Eric Fromm's work, The Art of Loving. Another book I had sitting on my shelf. I bought it when I was an undergraduate at UC Riverside for 27 cents on the used book table and carried it around with me through several moves. And finally, years later, decades later, sat down and read it. And what he talks about in there is the process of, and in fact, it's very clear to me in reading that book that he was a Zen student. Had to be. Just no other way. And but what he talked about was the developing the capacity to love, okay? And in some ways, I think that's what we're doing in Zen practice, is we're developing the capacity to love, okay? Because we're learning to let go. We're learning to allow the world in. We're letting the world in. We're taking down the barriers. We're letting the world in. We're letting experience arise. We don't fight that experience. We don't block that experience, okay? And so in some ways, that's what we're doing here. Okay, I don't know, Dogen and Bodhidharma might have just rolled over, but I don't know. That's the way it looks to me. Okay, that's what we're doing here. That's where the love and the compassion is in Zen practice. We don't sit around singing Kumbaya. So. Thank you.